So, yeah.
It is. Okay.
Yeah.
That's great. That's great news. We'll get it. We'll get further into New Silver in a little bit, but just in your experience, you know, with dealing with, you know, people who are looking to flip houses or rent houses and stuff, are you seeing a decline, or have you seen a decline, or are people still pretty willing to take out loans and do fix and flips? Hey, welcome to PayPod, where we bring you conversations with the trailblazers shaping the future of payments and fintech. My name is Kevin Rosenquist. Thanks for listening. Kirill Bensanov is the co-founder and CEO of New Silver, a company that provides financing solutions for real estate investors. They offer loans for various types of real estate projects, such as fix and flip, rental properties, and new construction. Their claim to fame? Using advanced technology to get real estate investors funding quickly. I'm talking in as little as 5 minutes, and all from a computer or even a mobile device. We chat about real estate, as well as Web3 and blockchain technology, which Kirill is extremely bullish on. Joining me now, Kirill Bensanov. My wife is a realtor, and I have a very important question for you I need to know an answer to. When are the interest rates coming back down?
Well, let me ask the man upstairs. I don't know. I don't know. I think probably, you know, everybody was ready for it this year. I personally have always had my doubts, and I'm not so sure anymore that it'll be this year.
Yeah.
If it is, it'll be very small. I think next year potentially, but it could be higher for longer. You know, I mean, I think it's really going to depend on if they still have the 2% inflation in mind. And as soon as we can get into twos, at least, I think we're going to start seeing some momentum.
How far do you think, in your opinion, in your experience, do you think it'll even come back down? I mean, will we ever see 3-4% again?
I think that's where it'll probably end up, unless there's a black swan event, which, you know, we've had too many of, but and we may continue to have them. And in that case, if they see a threat to the economy, they may take it down or near zero again, or zero, as they've done, you know, not too long ago. But I think 3-4 is realistic. Yeah,
it is. Okay, that's great. That's great news. We'll get further into New Silver in a little bit. But just in your experience, you know, with dealing with, you know, people who are looking to flip houses or rent houses and stuff, are you seeing a decline, or have you seen a decline, or are people still pretty willing to take out loans and do fix and flips?
I think what we've seen is a shift in our customer base, a shift towards people who are more experienced and who tend to do real estate investing for a living.
Right.
Whereas, you know, 2 years or so ago, we saw a lot more people that were kind of newcomers into the space, or were doing it part time and had another job, which I personally love. That's one of the aspects of our business that I really enjoy, is that we could really support entrepreneurs who are, you know, just trying to kind of get into a new space, or just regular people who had a job and wanted to make extra money on the side, right? And we were there to support that financing of those projects and things that we're doing. Today we're seeing, I don't think we're seeing a, you know, there's been a decline in transactional volume, of course. I think things have shifted. We're seeing larger loan size. People are doing more, you know, construction, like ground up construction type of projects, versus fix and flip, you know, where they would buy a property, fix it, and try to resell it. Now they'll try to buy a property in an area where perhaps land is more valuable, and just completely demolish the structure, build a, you know, a McMansion or whatever on top of it, right? A 5-7 bedroom house that they can then sell for lots more money. So we've seen a trend towards that. I think, you know, certainly it's had an effect. I mean, I think I still think the main driver in this space is the lack of supply, right? There's while demand has certainly fallen, the supply has fallen even further. People are, you know, I talk to people all the time, and they just say, like, hey, I'd like to move. I have this dream of, I don't know, moving down to North Carolina, but I'm not going to do it now because I've locked in a 2.5 5% mortgage for 30 years, and it just doesn't make financial sense. So there, a lot of people are kind of sitting on their hands waiting for something to happen.
Yeah, and who can blame them, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. It's interesting that you're seeing more people going for like the bigger payday, or at least the bigger house, the bigger sale. Does that mean that in what we're seeing is that people that have maybe a higher income are more willing to buy?
Yeah, I still think there's people with either sitting, you know, who have some cash they're sitting on, or folks that have had and continue to have higher incomes. And it seems that, yeah, I mean, it takes more to buy a property these days. You know, it's kind of unfortunate, I think, for a lot of folks, right? Because it's still the American dream to own a property. And I'd like to kind of see people succeed in that dream. I think it's a great way for people to build their nest egg and their retirement nest egg, and you know, be able to sort of move up in the world, right? A lot of folks have been able to get in and buy homes when they're relatively inexpensive. I mean, real estate's always expensive, right? There's never a time when it's like, hey, you know, homes are cheap right now. If you go back 100 years and ask somebody, they'll probably say the same thing, right?
Mm-hmm. It's all relative.
It's relative, right?
Yeah.
But I don't think that, I'm not an economist, so I haven't studied this specifically, but just things that I've read, it doesn't feel like, and it doesn't seem like the income of like the average of the median income has caught up to what the real estate has done in the last, you know, last half a decade or so.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah, I live in Colorado, and we had a boom right around the time that we lived here or we moved here. And we got kind of lucky. We bought right before the boom went crazy. But I mean, I was, when it was going nuts, I had friends who were putting in 5 offers a day and getting beat, like handily beat by people with cash. It was wild.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think what we've seen is when debt was free, or almost free, right? We've seen companies that would help with cash offers pop up, right? So you could go, even if you don't have the cash, you could sort of get approved by a company and then make a cash offer with, you know, knowing that like this, they'll back you until you get a mortgage and then pay it off. We've also seen, we just see like institutional buying to a scale that I don't believe has ever been out there before. And it seems that now that has subsided. So yeah, I mean, I think things have shifted. I mean, you know, I worry a little bit if they continue to keep the rates where they are today, what's going to happen in the housing market with all the other changes too. Like think about the lawsuit that was recently, I guess filed, I can't remember the state, but against the National Realtor Association that they lost, right? And now the commissions are going to be shifting. I don't think we've seen that quite yet, but that's going to happen, right? So all these changes taking place, and then the property values are still, you know, we're still seeing appreciation year over year, whether it's, you know, single digits or in some cases it's still low double digits. I mean, that's kind of unbelievable. But if they keep the rates up for a long time, I mean, I just worry that this is obviously a big part of the economy in the country, so that may get eroded a little bit.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, that lawsuit was a big topic of conversation in my house, obviously, having a realtor in the family. So it was something that was, it was definitely discussed. So be interesting to see what happens with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So by my count, you founded 5 companies. Is that correct?
Oh God, I lost count myself. You probably did a better job than me. That sounds about right. I mean, I think my first company, it was a real company that I actually sold, but it was back in college.
Was that U.S. web hosting?
Correct. Exactly correct. Yeah, I really have to dig back and remember this stuff. But yeah, it must have been around 5. You're right.
You're officially in my serial founder category, by the way.
Thank you.
Welcome.
I guess that's a good thing. You know, I think it keeps me agile and it keeps life interesting.
Yeah, I'm sure it does. What is it about starting a company from scratch that entices you so much?
I don't know. I think I've always been a bit of an ADD mentality personally. Could never really keep my focus for too long of a time. I think I'm good at like generating an idea that could be a revenue producer that could, whether it solves a problem, you know, makes things easier, more convenient, etc. And I think I'm good at like the initial stages of building a company. When it gets to be a certain size, I tend to get a little bit bored, and management, the day-to-day management of an organization is not my favorite thing to do, in all honesty. So I'm probably good at going from like 0 to 10 million in revenue, somewhere in that neighborhood, and then ideally I'd want to have either sell the business or have somebody else take over.
It's funny, we talk a lot about entrepreneurship on this show, and mostly about how difficult it is. Did you always see yourself being a founding companies or a company, or did you have other ambitions early on?
Yeah, no, I never saw myself. I never actually thought about it that deeply. I kind of...
It seems to be the case with most people. They kind of just end up doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, I'm kind of trying to think back to US web hosting. I was in school, so it was like, it was just something fun to do, and it brought in some extra cash, and kind of one thing led to another. I had no idea what I was doing, but ended up selling the company. It was a small web hosting company, it was kind of fun. And then, I never kind of thought the business I started afterwards, what was a IT services company. Computersupport.com. It's now called Stratus Point IT. I met my future business partner at a company that I was working at full time, and it kind of, again, just one thing led to another. It was not really well thought out, to be honest. I wish some things we thought out a little bit more. But,
I'm sure
kind of happened. Yeah.
Yeah. If you could. Yeah, I'm sure things would have been done slightly differently if you had known what you know now then.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But, it is, I think, being, while I was a little bit younger and then going into the unknown, that was exciting in itself.
Sure.
It's certainly a risk. So I think I was lucky that most of the companies turned out, well. So from a financial side of things, it's certainly a risk to start a business. If you're not successful, which I definitely had failings, and I think most founders would probably say the same, kind of just making sure that you could stay afloat financially is important. Before I had a family, I think it was a little bit easier. So it was just myself that would drown if something happened.
Yeah, you can just eat ramen noodles, whatever, right?
Right, exactly. So it's been a fun journey.
We're about the same age, judging by your LinkedIn page. So we remember a world where cordless phones were considered impressive technology. When did you first become interested in tech?
Very early on, I think. So I'm an immigrant. I moved to U.S. when I was in my early teen years. I was born in what was then the Soviet Union, now Belarus. And I moved here in my early teens. So I'm, trying to think back, but I believe even before I came here, so my father was a computer engineer back in Belarus, and I remember he would take me he worked at a university, and he would take me there, and I mean, technology was really far behind over there, so he would work on like perfo cards, I think they're called, which were like, cards with holes cut out in them. And that's how you could program a computer. And I would like help them load these cards.
No kidding. I've never actually seen one of those in real life. That's wild.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. I haven't seen one since then.
Yeah. But that's a technology that's probably not coming back.
That's hopefully not. Hopefully not. But they had a mainframe computer. I remember like an IBM mainframe, I want to say, with these huge magnetic round disc tapes, and I was like 10 years old carrying these huge discs around. And so that I think, and then, but also like, they did have, I think they, at the end towards us leaving, they did get personal computers installed. So, and I remember, the green screen, and like I'd have the arrows, and I played some games on there, and that was a lot of fun. So that was really like my first exposure. And then after moving to the US, we got a computer rather quickly, and I was like, just kind of became enamored. We set up our own BBS, bulletin board system. I don't know if your listeners would remember these. Maybe some would.
Some will, some won't, I imagine.
Right. So that was fun. Like we'd kind of just play around. I mean, I guess now thinking back to it, the BBSs of the day had kind of the same things that now we have apps for, right? Like Discord and other things. Like they had a chat room, right? They had forums. Where you could post things. I mean, it's all kind of basic, but you could do the same thing, right? Mm-hmm. So we chat, we post messages. At the time, the cloud, didn't exist, right? So you'd have to download software, run software off of your hard disk. So we do that. We download games, play games, probably do similar things. Not to the scale, probably, and not as quickly that people are doing today. I was on a 2400 baud modem when we started out.
What was your first computer?
Oh God, I think we put it together ourselves.
Okay.
I don't believe we bought any like branded computer from what I recall. So I think I remember going to computer fairs and buying parts, like, and with my father or like friends later, we put it together ourselves.
That's really cool.
Yeah,
that was really cool.
Yeah.
So you were programming too early?
Yeah, I wrote some code. I mean I think I was always I started programming a little bit later, so early days, probably just more into gaming and stuff like that.
Yeah, I used to program some games on a Commodore 64 with my brother, and that syntax error would drive me nuts. that was like my nightmare. It was so annoying. So now you ventured into the real estate world with New Silver. How did you come to go down this road and co-found this startup?
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. So I invested in a fix and flip fund in sort of post real estate crisis in the 2010s, early mid 2010s. A friend of mine ran this fund and it basically, did fix and flip. And that's kind of how I learned about the industry through this. And was always, just kind of always found it interesting. I always found fintech interesting and exciting, and it combines the technology and the financial aspect, right? And it's fast moving. So, I think one of the things that sort of pure play enterprise IT, which I was in before, one of the things that I didn't like was like the slow movement of the sales process and the development process and all of that. So you're building B2B software, it's a slow process, right? Like could take 90 days, 120 days to close a small deal, could take longer to close a larger deal. So I always found that a little bit slow with my ADD brain, I guess. and fintech, with the sort of the fast moving world of finance, I just found that more exciting. So my current partner, Alex, and myself, we'd actually, and our CTO, Alexei, we developed some software to price assets, right? It wasn't really specific to this, to price real estate assets back in like 2017, 2018. And we had other ideas initially, and then we looked at the software. And we saw that we had some beta testing going on, and essentially what the software could do, it's a pricing engine for residential real estate.
Okay.
It could essentially, use data to price property as is, and then using some inputs from a budget, price it after repair. And that was kind of our initial foray. So we saw that it was working. People were liking it. And we weren't really sure initially what we were going to do. Like, was this going to be a SaaS type of a venture or not? Like, we didn't love SaaS for the reason I just mentioned, and there are some other reasons there, but we decided to, my partner Alex is a lifelong real estate career guy. So, we decided to try our hand at becoming an originator. So I kind of run the tech and the business side of things. He oversees all of the, things that touch real estate, risk management, underwriting, things like that. And so, yeah, that's how we got started.
Interesting. So, but you, what made you go, how come you focused on, you know, fix and flips and, you know, cause you started with this residential thing and, but you're not really necessarily geared towards, you know, the average person. It's gotta be somebody who wants to fix and flip or rent or build, like build from the ground up, right?
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. We have three different types of loans, fix and flip, as you mentioned. That's people who, you know, buy a property and they don't want to demolish. They want to, you know, fix up whatever is in the inside, whether it's a light construction or a heavy construction type of a deal. Okay. Well, the guts are staying the same usually. And then we have a ground up product, which is basically for people who, you know, buy a piece of land and want to build or want to demolish an existing structure and rebuild. And then we have a more akin to a traditional mortgage. We have a DSCR based 30-year mortgage for rental, you know, properties.
Okay.
So I think, you know, we just saw that we could make a bigger impact in this space. There's obviously, this is a competitive space as well, but the traditional mortgage space was, I think the digitization of mortgage was already well on the way in the consumer lending space, and it wasn't in the private lending or you know, fix and flip construction lending. So we thought we could make a bigger difference in this subspace.
So you felt there was a good opportunity there.
Correct. Yeah, I think we felt like our technology expertise could be a differentiator for our clients. Yeah.
Was there anything particular that you saw in the space where you were like, we could do this, we could do better than this?
Yeah, I mean, it's really we started out with this instant approval idea, right? So we use our pricing engine to value property today and then after the construction, and then we provide an instant term sheet. So today, if our clients go to our website, if they have a new property they're looking for a loan on, they put in an address, answer a couple of questions. Under 5 minutes, they have their if they're approved, they have their proof of funds, so they can go out and make an offer, and they have a term sheet with everything, with all the, you know, terms and conditions, all the costs, et cetera. So they have a conditional approval in hand in under 5 minutes. So that's wow. Really our biggest differentiator now. And that's kind of the idea that we started. We've done a ton more stuff. Like, we kind of brought everything online. Our North Star is convenience, right? We want to make our differentiator is just being more convenient. So coming in, getting approved in under 5 minutes, you know, requesting your construction draws online, your inspections online, you're requesting payoffs online, you know, communicating with the underwriting team, doing everything online, seeing the whole process online as you kind of go through the pre-approval, the approval, the servicing, like the whole, you know, the whole life cycle of a loan. We want to be able to, you know, for folks to do everything on their phones or on their computers.
Wow, that's incredible to do all that in 5 minutes from a phone.
Yeah, we think it's pretty cool. And, you know, it's I think especially in the hotter markets, like as you're alluding to earlier, like people were making lots of offers. It was really difficult to secure that property, right? Because they're just getting so many offers. So that's, you know, in the hotter markets, our software does even better. Like we've got a ton of people using our software and never getting along with us, right? And we don't mind, that's okay. You know, they go through, they get the conditional approval, they go out and make an offer, maybe they've got their own cash, or maybe they've got, you know, another lender they want to use. That's fine, you know, we understand.
Okay.
Yeah, we don't require that they use us as their lender. We hope they will. I think the majority does, but some definitely don't. We've definitely seen many cases when people are, you know, they just tell us like, hey, we just needed the letter and we got approved. That's awesome. But, you know, we've got our own money or something like that.
Thanks for the help. We're going to go to these guys though.
Yeah, exactly. And that's okay.
I mean, whatever. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Tell me about Flip Scout. That seems like a pretty impressive product for finding potential investments, right?
Yeah, that's the idea. You know, it was kind of, proof of concept. It's still not fully developed in all honesty, but it works pretty well. I mean, it basically just looks at the properties on market, scours the on market properties. And then we've got some algorithms, again, in line with our pricing engine, kind of trying to figure out, it's not fully granular, right? It kind of looks at let's say you put in the zip code or the name of a town, it looks at all the residential properties in that town, and then it tries to figure out where the highest ROI is. So we've got actually quite, it's a free software, so folks can go out and just sign up and use it immediately. And we've got, you know, we never really like promote it. It's just a value add for whoever wants to use it. And we've got quite a few people using it. I mean, there's hundreds, if not thousands, on a daily basis that use it. We're not involved. We don't make money off of this in any way, shape, or form. We're not a realtor. You know, we're not involved in any of the sale of the property or anything else. We're just kind of helping them with the analytics part of it.
Do you think that there's a lot of just realtors out there who've stumbled upon the product and use it just for their own information?
I don't know. I mean, we've definitely heard from realtors using it. I don't know. You know, we don't really keep track. Again, it's a free product. We provide support if people ask a question, but you know, we don't have too much insight into who uses it and for what use case. It's mostly, I mean, I'd say it's probably like 90% people who are kind of new to the fix and flip world and are kind of looking around to find a property that, you know, is not as easy to uncover just using Zillow or something like that.
Yeah, Redfin or something like that. Yeah,
right.
That was what I was going to ask. Is it kind of does it kind of pull from all the different places? Mm-hmm. Is that why it can find, how can it find things that maybe you can't find on Zillow?
I mean, it doesn't, you know, it finds properties listed in a few different places. Yeah, so
okay.
I wouldn't say it's all like. If there is places that are kind of for sale by owner, you know, we don't like crawl all of the websites, but it's more or less like a search engine for, for residential real estate.
Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah.
That's really cool. That's very cool.
Cool. Thanks.
Web3. I Web3 fascinates me. You have a lot of experience with Web3 from what I could tell, in blockchain technology. What makes you so bullish on Web3 and blockchain technology?
Yeah, I mean, we could talk about this for a really long time, actually. I think there's so much there, but
there is. Yeah, I know. Yeah. I'm ending with this, but I'd love to get your some info from you, because you definitely seem like someone who knows a lot about it.
Yeah, and I think I'm really bullish on, you know, not specifically on cryptocurrency. We could put that aside, because a lot of people conflate the two, right? Blockchain is the technology, and cryptocurrency is the value that you can move, or the gas, you know, you pay for using that technology. So one, you know, you may have to use cryptocurrency to transact on the blockchain, or you may not. It depends on you know, the blockchain, right? There's some private chains that you don't need anything, right, to transact on and things like that. So I just want to kind of separate the two, right? I am bullish on the blockchain technology for real estate specifically, and there's a ton of other use cases, I think, but specifically for real estate, because I believe it can disintermediate, and I believe it can lower cost by removing complexities and removing middlemen in transactions that we do, you know, every day in real estate, right? Think about, and this is maybe somewhat down the line, right? So today, there are some things that happen on the blockchain. There are definitely people that use blockchain, for example, for fractionalization. So kind of taking the old or not so old, but a little bit older concept of crowdfunding and buying shares in a investment property, for example, right? So now you could use the blockchain, and instead of doing stuff on paper, right, you now can receive your share in the form of an NFT, for example, and it could sit in your wallet and essentially be the proof of your ownership of this share, right? That's just one of the many use cases. And you can get paid, for example, by just having this NFT in your wallet. Let's say they're paying out a monthly dividend payment. And so essentially, like, you know, you could get paid in whatever form of cryptocurrency the issuer decides to pay you in instantly. They could do it like on a daily basis or on an hourly basis if they want. But so that's one of the use cases. But think about like a larger use case, which would be, you know, transacting in real estate. Like if you're buying and selling real estate, think about how complex this process is. How many people are involved, right? You've got attorneys.
Crazy.
You've got settlement agents, title insurance. And how much cost does that add, right? That probably adds you know, a percent, you know, a point to the transactional cost, you know, aside from the realtor and everything else. Like, so the transaction cost itself is probably like 1% roughly of the, you know, of the value of the real estate, right? So if you think about, you know, the fact that like now when you're buying a piece of real estate, you've got to, you know, take out title insurance, for example, especially if you're getting a loan against it, right? So your lender's going to, he's going to force you to take out a lender's title policy, right? Because, and you know, this is there to protect the lender and other parties as well. But, you know, the fact that the title could have an encumbrance on it, a lien against it that nobody knows about, really, or maybe a claim will be, you know, somebody will have a claim against this title. So you buy a property and then, you know, a month afterwards, you get a letter from a law office saying that the property you now own isn't actually yours because the seller didn't actually own it because somebody else had a claim on it, right? So now like the title insurance should kick in and hopefully cover the, you know, if you end up having to, you know, give up the property, have it, you know, the title policy should cover the claim. But, you know, that's certainly an unpleasant thing and
yeah, and that'd be a huge pain in the butt.
Right, huge pain. And think about all the costs that you have to pay again. Yeah. So with blockchain, you know, it could be really, you know, simplified a lot. That's like similar to what I just mentioned for fractionalization, right? The transactions, the owner of that real estate could have a token in their wallet, and that really, like that token itself would signify their ownership, right? So if they control that token, that means that they have title to the policy. I mean, I think there's a lot of things
mm-hmm.
to think through. I'm kind of simplifying this, right?
Sure.
And then when selling it, you know, they send the token to like a smart contract, which is basically a, you know, piece of code that decides what to do in certain situations. So let's say the seller sends over their title in the form of a token to the smart contract. The buyer sends their currency to the same smart contract. Now the smart contract, and maybe there's like a legal component, right? Like the lawyer has their smart contract, which, you know, oversees this whole transaction. And then when it tells it, when the law smart contract says, hey, all the conditions have been met, you know, it happens programmatically, right? It, you know, so it tells the settlement smart contract to release the value in the title to the buyer and the seller, right? And now the transaction is done. So not only have we saved tons of time and the service providers that had to, like, you know, do this all by hand, you know, potentially this could remove them all together, right? Because a lot of this could be coded. And then now we mm-hmm. know, you know, this works perfectly, right? I mean, code isn't perfect, but over time it gets better and better, right? But and so, you know, at some point we could say, hey, this works. And if it doesn't work, there's a mechanism to unwind the transaction, right? So that has to be thought through as well. So there's a lot there. And well, obviously this industry is like, you know, hundreds of years old. Processes are so set in stone. And obviously there's businesses making money in all of these steps. So, you know, changing it is a huge deal, but I think there's people thinking about this and working on this already.
Yeah, that's an interesting point about all the people making money in the middle that don't want this to happen. And I think too, like you mentioned earlier about that you're simplifying your description and how you presented that. And that kind of brings me to a question of how can we make this technology more palatable for the average person? Because I feel like, you know, when I decided I wanted to learn, I was like, I got to learn what this stuff is. And I had to like sit down and learn what it was. And it wasn't like something that you just like, oh, that makes sense. Like right away, I had to like, you know, I had to like kind of dig into it and ask ChatGPT some questions and kind of figure out how exactly it works. What needs to happen in order for it to move forward so the general public understands it and is comfortable with it?
Yeah, I think what needs to happen is that we need to obfuscate the technology as much as possible from a regular user, right? We don't want a person who really, you know, is not interested in the technology and doesn't know how to use it, using you know, Web3 wallets, for example, and sending their title across really? In the form of a token. Because, you know, as it is today, in the majority of blockchain transactions are irreversible, right? So once you send something, unless there is a, you know, a smart contract or, you know, some other way to reverse, like if you're sending crypto from one wallet to another today, you know, once you've sent it, you click the send button, that value has left your wallet.
Done,
it's,
yeah.
It's done, right? Unless the other person wants to send it back to you. You know, so there's ways to work around it, but they haven't really been fully built out yet. So I think the main thing to do is build sort of user-facing applications, right? It's just like with, you know, with banking or mortgage, right? Like, we don't know or we don't care what happens behind the scenes when we click, you know, when we go to like Zelle or Venmo and we click send, right? We have no idea what happens, but the other person gets their money somehow. So
yeah, that's a good point. And we don't really care, do we? Like, right. We just know that it works. And so then we move on with our day.
Exactly. So yeah. We want the same thing here, right? We want the transaction to happen in the seamless possible way where, you know, if it's, whether it's the end user or, you know, again, some kind of intermediaries involved, but, you know, they click a couple of buttons and things just happen.
Yeah, that's a good point. I guess I kind of didn't think about that. There needs to be something on the front end that's very, very simple and with a great user experience. And that, so that, cause yeah, as it is right now, yeah, I have a wallet, and when I first got it, it was, you know, it was a little confusing, and you know, you had that crazy code that you have to get and like save somewhere. And like, there's a lot of steps involved. So yeah, that makes sense. Got to figure out a way for an easy front end app. That's, hey, you got to get working on that, Kirill.
I know that. I don't know if that's a challenge I'm willing to undertake at this moment in time, but it is super interesting though. I think the biggest challenge here is not a technology challenge, right? It's a business process, incumbent, challenge, right? Like, so it's, as you alluded to earlier, right? There's a whole industry around this, and, you know, it's cheap. And I hope there is, you know, what I said earlier about removing or disintermediating, I think that could happen, but I hope there is a way for, and I think there is a way for service providers to be involved, right? But being involved in a slightly different way, right? I think my belief is that any technology, and we could think about not just blockchain, I mean, any technology, web technology, right? Like DocuSign, right? We don't like it, you know, I don't know. We got, maybe it helped us remove fax machines or like notaries are not as, I don't know. Like, I'm just kind of making this up, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Now you could legally sign the document and send it across instantly, right? Think about that. I mean, now we kind of take it for granted, but that it probably had, you know, got rid of some folks' jobs or reduced their income and reduced what they do or changed what they do. So, but I don't think that's a bad thing, right? Because it lowers the cost of transactions for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, people can do more transactions, right? So I think it's a win-win. Whenever a new technology gets introduced, the incumbent industry is always like, whoa, whoa, whoa. You know, we don't want that. This is going to...
Right, yeah, sure.
This is going to, you know, destroy our small business. Well, yes, but you also can't put the genie back in the box, right? Once the technology is out there, and if it works, you know, it's really hard to regulate that tech and say that, hey, we're not going to let people use this new technology, even though we know it lowers costs, speeds things up, makes things easier, whatever. But we're going to let, you know, the old way persist. I mean, it happens in cases, it certainly does. But I think it's not as straightforward anymore. But I think, you know, I think if people are a little more open-minded and they embrace that technology, they could find a new use case for their business. I mean, things are always changing. Like, right, we're, you know, now with AI, think about what that's going to do. I mean, that's going to revolutionize. And certainly people will lose their jobs, right? Like, I mean, I could already see, you know, a lot of jobs at risk. Like, people are already saying that they reduced their workforce. I just read today, I think it was a small medium business survey, and people have said like some 16%, I believe, of their tasks have moved to AI. Just high level, but I think it's going to be a lot more than that.
I agree, and I think a lot of what I've read is because I've been in marketing for a long time, and the marketing world was very nervous about AI for a multitude of reasons. And a lot of it was just like, the best thing you can do is learn about it, you know, learn about AI, learn about what, and then figure out a way to implement it in your day to day. And instead of, you know, instead of looking at it as like, I'm going to lose a job, you look at it as, okay, what other opportunities will this provide me? And maybe that's the same thing that can happen to some of those, you know, middlemen in the real estate process.
Absolutely. I mean, that's key. Learn the technology and embrace it and be the first to embrace it.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll be that invaluable consultant. You'll be that resource that people will go to use the new technologies. So there's always a way as kind of tech changes our lives, and there's always a way to be successful using that.
What are one more question for you? I'm curious about: are there any use cases of blockchain technology that perhaps most of us aren't thinking about, but you've thought about that could be really, you know, make big changes?
I mean, I'm really focused on real estate, so
right.
I think in real estate, you know, these are like huge changes, which I think, you know, related to transaction, related to investing. You know, I think there are definitely use cases which are already in play today. Like, I mean, even the simplest of like moving money, right? Moving money from internationally, right? Like remittance payments. I mean, people are already using, institutions are already using private blockchains, maybe public blockchains in some cases, to move value from one country to another. And that's, mm-hmm. you know, there's trillions of dollars of value being moved cross border every year, right? So that, and it costs a fair amount of money to move to perform those moves in some cases. So, I mean, even the simplest use cases are very valuable. I always like to think of the simple things. I mean, I think the simple things are the ones that change industries.
Yeah.
You know, and I think start there. We haven't really adopted blockchain fully, or we're not even close to that today. So I do think there's going to be some awesome use cases that I haven't thought of, or none of us have thought of. But there are the simple ones that I'm hoping will get implemented into the everyday lives as quickly as possible.
Well, Kirill Bensonov with New Silver, thank you very much for joining me. And yeah, I could keep talking Web3, but we'll bring you back on for part two sometime.
Awesome, Kevin. It was great talking to you.
Okay, thanks again for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you.